I know bad taste, but to know bad taste, you have to know all the rules of good taste, which my parents painstakingly taught me. That's probably why I rebelled. I was almost fascistly good taste I was raised with, but I'm thankful for it, actually, because you can't have fun with bad taste unless you know the rules to break.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. John Waters has done a little bit of everything. He helped usher in the era of the midnight movie with his 1972 film Pink Flamingos. He took his style mainstream in 1988 with Hairspray. He gave Johnny Depp his first lead role in a film. He took over Broadway in 2002 with a musical adaptation of Hairspray, which won 8 Tony Awards. He's written books, done one-man shows, and even hitchhiked across America. Crowned the Pope of Trash by no less than Naked Lunch author William S. Burroughs, John Waters' latest project is perhaps his most unexpected to date, a retrospective at the Baltimore Museum of Art called, of course, Indecent Exposure. The show, on view now through January 6, 2019, features more than 150 provocative photographs, sculptures, and video and sound works made over the past 25 years. We recently sat down with Mr. Waters to chat about this and a few other things. How did the exhibition come about? Did it originate from you? Were you approached by the museum? You know, what was the...
I was approached by the museum. This show wouldn't have worked in the beginning of my career because everybody would have said, oh, it's in Baltimore, that's why. You know what I mean? But since I've been doing it since 1992 and I had another museum show that went to 4 places and was at the new museum and I've had shows all over the world, now was the exact right time to come home to Baltimore, to the Baltimore Museum, where I first was bit by the contemporary art bug when I was about 10 years old and saw how angry contemporary art made other children, and I loved it. So that's how I became a collector.
Talk about that for a minute in the sense of, you know, were you a avid museum-going kid? Did your parents take you to the museum?
Nobody's an avid museum-going kid when they're 10. Their parents have to take them or something. You know, I wasn't going to just... I didn't live near the museum, so... No, my parents took me. And I would look at the contemporary art, and I remember I took this little Miró print home, and it's actually in the case at the show, you know, the ephemera case. And I hung it up in my bedroom, and another neighborhood kids, that's hideous. Why would you put that up there? And I was so amazed at the power that it had to infuriate people, because I already kind of was, something was the matter with me. I knew it. So I was I loved it. So I became friends with contemporary art right in the beginning, and I still love contemporary art that makes you angry. I mean, I even have a piece in my show that says contemporary art hates you, and it does if you hate it first.
So when you're a kid looking at, you know, Miró and you're starting to understand what that is, and now it's, you know, 60 years later and you have a show at the same space. And what is that like to kind of have that journey? Is it surreal?
Well, it's lovely, and I'm not dead. That's what's the best part about it. You know, what used when I was young, what was out front of the museum was the Thinker, the sculpture, and now Big Banner of Divine is out front. So there is a certain irony there, but at the same time, you know, anything that has to do with art is always about extreme taste in some way. So it's not so surprising, but it's lovely, and it's great because the Baltimore Museum was very, very important to me always. So and Brenda Richardson, who the catalog is dedicated to, she was chief curator there for a long time, and she taught me really, really a lot about art.
How many pieces are in the show? It's a pretty big show.
Well, that, you know, I have to look at the thing. something. I think 170 or something.
Yeah, it's a lot. But I'm sure that's obviously still not everything. So how did you start?
Oh, no, it's not.
How did you start to whittle it down?
The curator, really, Kristen Heilman, she did it all, and she grouped it, and she came with me with the idea in the beginning and everything about how to do it. And so I liked really how she saw it and in different kind of subjects. It's not chronological order. And then we hung it together in a model. We built a model and hung it. We clicked right from the beginning. And then when we got there, we just hung it. It was almost exactly like how we did it in the model. And I think she really had a new, fresh idea of how to look at it.
And would you consider the show in any way to be biographical? Meaning if someone walks in and they don't know you or your work at all, by the time they're done with the show, what will they know about you as a person and kind of what your point of view is?
I think the most important thing that they would probably understand what my sense of humor is about. I think that's the kind of whole point, because I celebrate failure. I celebrate insider knowledge about the art world and the movie business, but I always really make fun of things I love. So I don't think I'm ever mean-spirited. So at the same time, no one seems to get mad. You know, I had a docent training where, you know, some of them are elderly women, and I had to show them 12 assholes and a dirty foot, you know, and they just laughed, you know. Nobody seems to, I mean, the people that would hate it don't come. They don't come to see a show called Indecent Exposure by John Waters if they think they're going to somehow, if they're, I don't know, right-wing Christians. Not that many come that I know of. I haven't heard any adverse reaction, even when on the cover of the Baltimore Museum of Art's monthly calendar that they mail to all members, on the cover was Have Sex in a Voting Booth, which was a piece I did. And I think one person complained that they got more members than ever.
Well, there's always that one.
Yeah. So, I feel bad if there wasn't that one. I think I've lost something. But, you know, in a way, I wouldn't feel that, because I haven't really changed much from the very first thing I ever did to today. It's not that different. But everybody else has changed, and kind of that sense of humor that I always had is now mainstream American humor.
You've always had this outsider status, and you've always been there. And like you said, you're still you. Culture changed. The world caught up to you. Do you feel...
I'm not an outsider anymore. Are you kidding?
Right. So
I'm an insider.
And does that make
That's
you...
That's even more perverse.
Does that make you want to do something that gives you, reestablishes your outsider credit and like push the boundaries?
I'm always updating my street cred. I mean, that's why I hitchhiked across America by myself at 66 years old. That's why I have a work in this show that if you step over the insurance lines like Museum had, sometimes it squirts you in the face with water. You know, I'm always trying to make fun of the rules, certainly. But no, I don't feel like I have to try too hard. No, that's a sin. That's the ultimate sin, I think. That's why I don't make gross-out movies anymore, because Hollywood does now, and they cost $100 million, and most aren't funny.
That's why
I make Kitty Flamingos, which is in the film, which is a video piece that's really, I rewrote Pink Flamingos for children and have all children read it.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I was 8 years old when I saw Hairspray in the theater, and, you know, I think in some ways some of the most subversive things you ever did were things like getting me to go in there to a PG. Was it rated PG? I think it was rated
PG.
It
was PG. That was a Trojan horse, definitely.
And when I was a kid, I loved, 50s music, because my parents were boomers. They loved that music, and so I think I went because I thought that the movie was about that, so I really kind of got hooked in.
Well, it was in some ways about that.
But the great thing, I think, to me was you had these issues of race and segregation that were in this movie that, you know, I would have never thought about when I was 8 or 9 years old. But, you know, it was kind of getting into my brain in a...
It was a Trojan horse. It was the only devious movie I ever made, because Pink Flamingos is preaching to the converted. But Hairspray, as I said recently, the Academy of Arts and Science had a 30-year anniversary of it, and they showed it in their theater. There were big Oscars on the stage. It was hilarious and lovely. But even racists like Hairspray, which is really bizarre.
So everybody could find their entry point into Hairspray, I guess.
I guess. You know, it doesn't seem to... And I've even seen it now in the ultimate political correctness. In the schools, they can't cast by weight or by race or anything. So I've seen it with a thin black girl playing Tracy, and it makes no sense, but kids don't notice that. So it's even better.
Yeah, totally. And so when
you're... The plot makes no sense. They don't see that because they're colorblind still, which is great.
So I wonder when you started... When did you start focusing more, or not more, but this kind of art, visual art, doing other things? Because your
in
life
1992,
was...
I did it in the beginning, but I did it secretly. I didn't tell anybody, but Colin Delam was an art dealer, but I really, really loved what he showed, and so I went to see every show and all, and he said to me once, "Do you ever do anything?" And I said, "Well, I have these little pictures." He said, "What do you mean you have these little pictures?" So I already had the first show, but I didn't know if I was ever going to show it to anybody, so that's how it sort of started. It was definitely Colin Delam, who was an incredibly respected art dealer, and without him, I don't know if I could have ever gotten in a world that is basically very distrustful of outsiders, especially from show business.
What itch does doing this kind of art scratch that making movies or any other kind of thing, like writing books, doesn't do?
It's all the same for me. I'm telling stories in a different way. I'm rewriting. And in the museum show, it's a show about editing because I'm taking images from other people's movies, photographing them in a much worse way and low-tech way, and then rewriting them in storyboards to make up completely new narratives that I think up that become my movies, hopefully, if it's successful.
I love what you've done with Ansel Adams. Can you kind of describe what you've...
It's called Cancel Ansel, and Ansel Adams was one of the first photographers that made photographer be thought of as contemporary art. It certainly was not thought of as fine art, and there was certainly in the 40s and certainly people that were very much against that. So he was the first one that did it. I am the opposite of that. I am the opposite of Ansel Adams. So I went in his photographs and put in like cruise ships and litter and fat people swimming and just the worst kind of stuff. Not that I'm against any of those things. Well, I'm not against fat women swimming. I'm against litter. But still, to kind of deface the idea of good taste in contemporary photography, which, because I'm celebrating failure in photography, basically, completely I am.
So what, when you were younger, you talked about Miro and finding this print that really made an impact on you. Who were some of the other artists as a young person that really spoke to you in a real important way?
Well, when I read about Life magazine, I pretended secretly that I was nude descending a staircase when I was about 9 years old and used to come down the steps every morning imagining that I was the Duchamp painting. And then I have a silver Jackie Warhol print that was $100 I got in 1964. So I think pop art and surrealism when I was young, certainly when I saw that, and Jackson Pollock. You know, Life magazine was what you saw when you grew up in suburbia, you know, not New York or somewhere. So I thought beatniks, and beatniks loved abstract art and Jackson Pollock and everything. So certainly that. I always knew that the arts wept what came before, and that always appealed to me, that it outraged people.
So you said, you know, of course, as a kid, you would never make the conscious decision to say, take me to the museum, but your parents take you to the museum to see...
Well, I would after I went, I would have, yeah.
After that first exposure, did your parents enjoy the museum, or did they feel like they took you because you needed to see this thing?
They hated the kind of art I had. They still did. Till the day they died, my father would look at my art collection and just say, "You bought that? They saw you coming, boy." But my dad was the only one that I would ever, ever show auction results prices to, which I would never do. That's so gauche about. But to my dad, it was the only way, and he would shake his head in horror when he would see that. Some of the things I bought, you know, I never sold them, but just to see how much they might have been worth, that to my father was the ultimate kind of head-shaking thing. He even did a piece that he gave me on a cardboard from a shirt that said crazy written. It looks exactly like Cy Twombly. He didn't mean to. He hated the Cy Twombly prints I had, but he did that, and it was really lovely. I thought he did get it. He just didn't realize he got it.
Do you try to stay up on you know, who's doing what now, like contemporary artists? Do you go to a lot of galleries?
Oh, yeah, I go to the galleries all the time. I go every 3 weeks and see 10, 15, 20 galleries.
Oh, wow, okay. And so are you...
In New York, because I have an apartment in New York, too.
Yeah. What's your favorite museum in New York? Is there kind of a spot that's not the traditional?
I'm not picking that. Certainly the new museum gave me... I was the last show they had before they moved in their old museum, so I have a great soft spot for them.
Yeah. So in the 25 or so years since you've really been kind of moving in this direction with this art, has there been an acceleration at any point as far as how much you're creating at a given time? You haven't made a film for a while?
No, because If I'm writing a movie, I'm not thinking up artwork. If I'm doing a book, as soon as I finish the book, then I'll think, once this show's open up, I think, what's the next art show going to be? So I work at, I even have a whole different place I work on. I go to my studio to work on the art. I don't write. I have a writing room here. I have different areas, but I can only do one thing at a time.
A lot of the pieces seem...
I do have cubby holes where I throw ideas, so I have plenty of ideas, a lot of post-its.
Well, do these ideas come to you fully formed for the most part? Because it seems like there's a conceit at the heart of a lot of these works. So does the idea say, okay, that's my next thing?
Yes. They're conceptual. I think every one of them up before I do it. I think it up. Then I have to go find the images to take off the TV screen. I have to find the images. It's like a snipe hunt. I have to go through thousands of movies sometimes to find pictures of bears or holes without another or mouth coming towards it. You have to find the things, the images that you want to write with.
And is that the most fun part of the process, kind of the pursuit once the initial thought happens? Or is it the moment where you
wait
a second?
Most fun of everything I do is thinking it up.
This would be a great idea.
I think that'll work. Yeah.
And does that faucet have different speeds at which the ideas come and go? Are you inspired by just anything? You'll go to a movie, you'll go to a show, and then all of a sudden something might pop into your mind?
Yes, it could be on anything. It could end up being in a book. It could be in an art show. It could be in a movie. It could be in my spoken word show, my Christmas show. Yes, it could. All those things happen. I have different. I'm looking right now. I have like 15 cubby holes, and they go in different places.
Do you expect?
Sometimes they go from one to another too.
The overlap. Yeah. Do you ever plan to travel this show? Has there been talk about kind of?
Yeah, it's going to the Wexner after here.
Oh, great. And what do you think, like I said, you are so associated with the city of Baltimore. Do you think it will make any difference if the show is in a different city, how people will react to the work?
No, because I've had art shows all over the world and people kind of react the same way. I don't think it will. I'm not saying that any audiences are more or less sophisticated or everything. I think the people, I think it will be understood the same way in any city.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking, if this show were to go somewhere like, Mobile, Alabama Museum of Art or the Birmingham
Museum. It would
be fine.
It would work.
Yeah.
Here's why. Because I do my spoken word show. I've done even my Christmas tour in 17 cities. I've done my spoken word show in Mobile. I've done it in those kind of cities. The people that come see me, they look exactly like the same people that would come in Paris or New York. There's cool people everywhere.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And they don't have to move anymore. They don't have to move to New York now. They stay where they are and make it better. So I think it's completely different now. I think every city is cool, and people should stay where they are and not come to New York because it's too expensive for new ideas to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I've heard the argument that, any city of a certain size, no matter if it's in the South, Northeast, anywhere, kind of reaches a critical mass where the culture has the same offerings at some point. There's kind of this moment where...
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by 72 degrees Fahrenheit, the official perfect temperature for museums around the world. Don't be fooled by those rascally outliers claiming 68 or 70. The consensus choice by the Society of Museum Meteorologists is 72 degrees. In the depths of winter, it's 72 degrees in the museum. When summer swelters and asphalt melts, it's 72 degrees in the museum. Your comfort is our concern, but honestly, not as much as protecting the art. 72 degrees. Period. You're welcome.
When you're in the process of putting this exhibition together and you're working with the curator and you're, the living artist, what's the boundary line between what the curator does for the show and what your input is on the show, and how did you guys work together?
Well, luckily, we never got anywhere near that boundary because we agreed on everything. If she if I said, I think this one should be in there, or I don't know if that was going. I mean, we might have said a few of them, and we both said okay. Kristen knew how I hung my show. She had seen him in every show I've ever done is hung kind of the same way. So she was never trying to change that. But I never would have come up on my own with the idea of grouping them the way she did and different stuff, which I think she did a very, very good job. I think she was dead on right.
Is there an audio tour of the show?
There is. I mean, I do a little. It's not like I go. It seems like I have to be the human acoustic guide all the time. But yes, there is one. But I don't know if it's on. It's not on every piece, I don't think.
Is it in your voice? Are you doing it?
I did some of it, yeah. But other people did some too. Yeah, it's not all me. Now, I've been hired to do, I think I did the Cindy Sherman one at the Museum of Modern. I did a couple other ones, but I was a hired voice.
Yeah. The catalog for the show is just totally beautiful, and it's a
work of art
in and of itself. The show has a title that seems perfect, and you'll go, yeah, that's what a show, a John Waters exhibition retrospective should be called. But I wonder, were there a bunch of other options? Did you have to go through a million
times? Well, I think my assistant, Susan Allenbach, thought up that title.
It's a great title, but it's also...
She said, how about this? Oh, that's perfect. You know, and I'm like, we had a bunch of different ones, but I never remember the ones that don't win because they're forgotten.
But it seems like, you know, you come back to sometimes the one you go, well, yeah, that's what it should have been in the first place. I'm sure, you know, title.
Yeah, but this one was right away. Everybody agreed.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't think there was too much... You know, you think back, like Hairspray was originally called White Lipstick, so you never know.
So 2004 was your last film, and you've had this 14-year gap, and in that time, you've done so many things. You've done books, you've got
I'm busier than I've ever been in my life. I have more jobs than I've ever been.
And I'm just wondering, you know, is that why, I guess, you know, why are you staying so busy?
Because, but I am in the movie business. I've had two scripts that they totally paid me to write and never made, including HBO for the sequel to Hairspray. So it hasn't, like, I have not been in the world. They just don't make them. And the independent film world, now they want you to make a movie for $1 million. I can't be an anarchist at 72, you know.
Well, I wonder, you know, with the advent of, you know, all these streaming platforms, they're all reaching out.
Yeah, I know, but I, you know, to me, my books do better. I mean, I just turned in my new book that I took 3 years to write, and the publisher loved it, so I'm really happy. It's called Mr. Know-It-All. It comes out next spring. So,
What is this book?
It's called Mr. Know-It-All, and it's my opinion on everything. But my books, my last two books, certainly did better than my last movie.
But they wouldn't have if you hadn't built up your you had to do everything you did.
I don't know if that's true. Right, well, I'll argue that point because both Shock Value and Crackpot are still in print, and they've never gone out of print, and the first one came out in 1980.
So do you spend the same amount of time and dedication when you're working on a book? Are you kind of a workaday kind of person? You say, I got to get this done. I've got a deadline. Are you sitting there doing that? Or are you kind of doing it when inspiration hits and you write a little bit at a time?
Oh, no. I am so organized, you would vomit. I work every day. I get up Monday to Friday, get up at 6 a.m. I start writing, thinking up something every day at 8 o'clock, not 8:01, not 7:59. At 8 o'clock, and I usually go to about 11:30, and then have my meeting with the people that work for me, and then my afternoon, I run my film empire. But in the morning, everyone knows I'm unreachable. I don't have my computer on, but it's been like that for decades.
But then, like, the visual art, in some ways, the fact that it does come on a whim.
If I'm doing that, I'm over at my studio at 8 a.m. working on it.
But they never overlap.
But the ideas.
Okay.
The ideas come... if I'm awake, because I dream sometimes and write them down. They're never good, though, if that happens. When you wake up and read them, you think, what is this nonsense?
So the title of the exhibition, you know, speaks to the fact that the whole point of the show is to push boundaries and push the envelope, and that's who you are. But was there any discussion of anything that was too far for the show? Did you have to edit anything out of the show? I would imagine not, but...
I don't think so. My favorite thing about pushing the envelope is the cover of the book has dirt marks on it, but they're printed like that. So that's really, I think, edgy because publishers and people sometimes won't buy it because they think it's a soiled copy.
They'll be like, can I get another one of these? Can I get a new one?
If they have more, they just show them. Look, it's on every cover, but dirt's in the exact same place. But I'm really thrilled at that because it's not even obvious. It just looks like it got a little damage, which I'm really thrilled about. So, we do have 12 pills and a dirty foot. I can't, if any of them was going to be taken out, it might have been that one. I even have the ones that are artistically incorrect that say things like, all photographs fade. That's not something you usually hang in a museum, that it is a photograph.
Is there any kind of disclaimer or age restriction on entering the show?
Yes, but it's weak, I think. There's one corner you come around that says, warning, something. I forget what it says. They can tell you, but it's not that strong. And I said, has anybody come in with children? They say, oh, some people come in and go, oh, let's go over here. They don't freak out. But there's a big bottle of spilled poppers, and there's Bill's stroller, which is a child's stroller with logos of sex bars all over it. But was there anything that we didn't put in because we thought it would be too much to have in a museum? No.
Is there any, so you mentioned Hairspray being, you know, the only subversive film you ever really made. Is there any piece in the show that you think people might look at and kind of glance over, but they may not realize how truly subversive it is until maybe they get
home? I wouldn't call myself subversive because that's a compliment to me to let others say that. But there is a piece that is just the titles of two movies that you'll never, no one's ever remembered, Dr. Dolittle 2 and Knight Riders. I mean, movies that no one remembers. Why are they there? Well, because those were the movies that were showing, about to be shown on the planes on 9/11. So to me, that's pretty much of a whoa when you know what it is. So that horrible little detail makes it either better because at least they didn't show them while the planes were crashing, or worse because you know that horrible, trivial little thing about a terrible day.
Well, and you have other pieces that reference 9/11. There's one I'm thinking of that kind of references visuals from the planes hitting the building, and kind of corresponding images with other
flying saucers.
Flying saucers.
1950s horror movie. Yes, because that was a favorite kind of campy. I would never say that word, but now that the Met is having a show called that, I guess you have to say it again. a campy kind of sci-fi 50s movie. It was funny, but now when you see something smashing into a building in Washington, it's not quite so funny. So things change. You know, I have to have sex in a voting booth, a giant campaign button. That was done before Trump. And now maybe it's true. Maybe it should do that.
And so the, you know, something that we once saw as pure entertainment, real events intervene, and then all of a sudden either it's, you know, we can't talk about those things anymore, or we can't show those things anymore because this one thing happened.
It's context.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's editing and context, how something suddenly that was so innocent can become horrifying. But isn't that what art is? A magic trick that makes you see something in a different way, and then you can never go back to seeing once you learn how to see, and that's what going to museums does.
I want you so more than you know. Need you more than you know. More than you know.
In 1987, at the Stux Gallery in New York City, American artist Andre Serrano debuted a new work, a photograph of a small plastic crucifix submerged in a glass tank of the artist's own urine. Officially titled Immersion (parentheses Piss Christ), the image would later be known simply as Piss Christ. After the work won an award sponsored in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the real controversy began, with multiple accusations of blasphemy. Serrano received death threats and hate mail. Critics alleged that the government funding of Piss Christ violated the separation of church and state. Nearly 25 years after its debut, on April 17, 2011, a print of Piss Christ was vandalized, quote, beyond repair, by Christian protesters while on display at a gallery in Avignon, France. Serrano, now nearing 70 years old, has always defended the photo as a serious work of Christian art, noting that Piss Christ shows a more graphic depiction of the crucifixion, and further noting that it is an intensely realistic moment when not only blood was spilled, but all other bodily fluids and waste as well. Maybe if Piss Christ upsets you, said Serrano, it's because it gives you some sense of what the crucifixion actually was like. I was born and raised a Catholic, and I've been a Christian all my life. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.